All right, here's a quiz. When did the first permanent British settlement in North America get founded? That's right, 1607 in Jamestown. Very good. Now, when did the British American colonists declare their independence from England? 1776. Excellent. Now, that's 169 years of history. Do you know anything else that happened during that time? Anything at all? Okay, French and Indian War. Okay, if you guess that one, good for you. 1750s, 1760s. What happened during the other 100 or so years? Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, today we're going to tell you a little bit about this very important part of history. We're going to tell you about something called Bacon's Rebellion. And to tell you, we're going to take you to a place called Bacon's Castle. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And today, it's all about Bacon's Castle.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
This show is all about something we call the American experiment, or more fully, the American experiment in self-government. It's something that Alexander Hamilton identified in the very first part of the very first Federalist paper when, I'll paraphrase here, he said, it seems to have fallen to us to determine whether people can choose their own form of government through reason and discussion rather than through force and rather than having it imposed upon them by some king or general or other. That is the American experiment. It's an open-ended experiment, and every day we find out whether we're still free at the end of the day, whether we're still governing ourselves. Doesn't mean we're perfect. Doesn't mean that there aren't things we can improve. Believe me, we criticize things that need criticizing around here. But by and large, seems to be working. And sadly, when you look at other places in the world, and I'm thinking of the Middle East, where hopes were so high over the Arab Spring a few years back, or maybe some places in Eastern Europe and Russia or China, where hopes have waxed and waned over the years for democratic reforms. Why do we seem to be succeeding and others not so much? Is it because we've been ordained by God? Well, perhaps. Is it because Americans are somehow exceptional or special? Well, I don't know about you, but I've met a lot of people from other nations, and it seems to me that Americans are pretty much like people everywhere. In fact, we are a nation of people from everywhere. So I don't know if you can make that case that we're somehow better than other people. So is there some just sort of rational, logical reason why we seem to be succeeding in governing ourselves? The best reason I've ever heard in the years that I've been studying our constitutional history is this, that we had over 150 years of practice. English settlers first came to Jamestown and formed the first permanent English settlement here in 1607, and the Americans then declared their independence in 1776. Now, by my arithmetic, that's 169 years, and during all that time, we were kind of like kids who had been sent off to college. And you send your kid off to college, and he's a few hours away, or she's a few hours away, and she gets to more or less run her life, and yet you still have some supervisory authority. I mean, you still hold the purse strings. You know how that goes. But bit by bit, over the course of the 4 years, he or she becomes a successful, we hope, independent adult. Well, in much the same fashion, England sent over a bunch of settlers, and simply because of the logistics, simply because it took weeks to cross the Atlantic Ocean, the king and his counselors couldn't control American colonists on a day-by-day basis, so they had to govern themselves, subject, of course, to the ultimate control of the mother country. And, of course, that led to friction, just as it does between parents and children, and eventually emancipation of the American colonies. We had our college years. We had 169 years of college, or if you prefer, 169 years on training wheels, before we actually said, okay, we're on our own now, and now we're going to attempt this American experiment. Well, have you ever wondered about what happened during the early part of that experiment? We didn't just go straight from Jamestown to Philadelphia in 1776. You might remember things like the French and Indian War and, you know, the strife of the 1760s and the Stamp Act and the Townshend Act. Yeah, but American history didn't begin in 1754. There were about 150 years before that where lots of important stuff was going on. And today we're going to tell you about one very important thing, a thing that happened almost exactly 100 years before the American Revolution, around 1670, happened in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and it happened not far geographically from places you have heard of, places like Yorktown and Williamsburg. In fact, the place we're going to visit today, and next week, because this is such a cool story, is a place just across the James River, just south of Yorktown, and it's a place called Bacon's Castle. Now, it's not really a castle, and it wasn't even owned by a guy named Bacon, but don't worry, we'll explain about that in a little. But it was part of something called Bacon's Rebellion. And although it's not possible to trace a straight line from Bacon's Rebellion to the American Revolution, this was, in some sense, a precursor. It was a very significant attempt by at least some American colonists to rebel against British rule, and it involves some shooting and some burning down of buildings and lots of excitement. Now, to tell us about it are a couple of marvelous ladies from something called Preservation Virginia. It's a wonderful organization. We'll hear more about them as well. Suffice it to say at the moment that Preservation Virginia does exactly what its name implies. It preserves important historic sites in Virginia. One of those sites is Bacon's Castle, which just happens to be celebrating its 350th anniversary this year. So let's go on to the castle, and let's talk to Jen, and let's talk to Joanna.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Hurst Wender, and I am the Director of Museum Operations for Preservation Virginia.
Hi, I'm Joanna Braswell, and I'm the Site Coordinator for Bacon's Castle.
You just gave away the ending. We're at Bacon's Castle. That's all right. Absolutely. Thank you, Joanna. Very nice to see you here today, and thank you for getting up and coming out here with us. And you're not feeling well today, so thank you doubly for doing that. What a nice thing it is for you to come out and help us with this. Okay, Jen, I'm going to let you explain how we got here.
Being the Director of Museum Operations for Preservation Virginia, I have the privilege of managing five of our historic sites across the state. We are at the John Marshall House, but we also own and operate Cape Henry Lighthouse, Smith's Fort Plantation, Patrick Henry Scotch Town, and also Bacon's Castle. And Bacon's Castle in 2015 is celebrating its 350th anniversary. So,
Wait, 350 years? I thought we all just magically popped into life 200 and some odd years ago.
Right, 1776.
Well, I realized there was Columbus, right? And then the next day it was the Declaration of Independence, right?
Well, there was also 1607 and Jamestown.
Oh, yeah, forgot those
right.
guys. Okay,
and,
okay.
And then Preservation Virginia does also own and operate historic Jamestown.
So, tremendous, yes. Which I just drove past this morning, and I drove past the Smith's Fort Plantation. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, you give me a list of places to go, but the point I was trying to make is that I think in most American history books, and Joanna, you and I were talking about this a moment ago, you get these little bitty mentions of these very important events that happened during the 17th century, the 1600s, and we just don't know anything about them.
Right. You sort of skip from Jamestown and Pocahontas to American Revolution in me, you know,
right.
cases. So
That's the Disney version of history.
There's a lot of good information in between in the 17th century. If nothing else, just really establishing the colonies, especially with Virginia, the political and social structure that we came to know, basically.
This is a site that I had never heard of. It is an event that I probably heard of in eighth grade and promptly forgot. And so I'm very, very excited to be here. Why is Bacon's Castle important?
Bacon's Castle is important for several different reasons, but one is the idea that a house that is this grand and this large was built in the 17th century. At that time, it wasn't known as Bacon's Castle. It was known as Arthur Allen's Brick House.
Right, and it is. We should interject here. It doesn't look like a castle. I mean, there's a reason it was called that, but it's basically a great big 17th century brick house. It's a grand house.
It is. It's a grand house. In fact, it would more closely associate itself with an English manor home, mm-hmm. which is what it's modeled off of. It's actually one of one of three examples of High Jacobean architecture.
High Jacobean architecture. Okay,
right.
explain it for the uninitiated. High Jacobean.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so Jacobean architecture was popular with James I. So you're talking the late to mid 1500s. Probably the latest in England that you would ever see a Jacobean house would be 1630. You won't find any being built after 1630 in England.
So this was an old style even when it was
right,
built.
Exactly.
And what was the year it was built, Joanna?
So this is finished in 1665.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was like building a house today that's like an arts and crafts house or something. It's just it's not the current style.
It's not the current style in England. However, you know, it's emblematic of the English, and definitely Arthur Allan the First, who
was it Allen A-L-A-N or
A-L-L-E-N?
Okay, Arthur Allan the First.
Arthur Allan the First. He was a merchant and tobacco planter, and did hold many traditional values, and which you can see obviously through the architecture of this building. I mean, there weren't at that time. This is a basically 5,300 square foot house, and when you think about early Virginia architecture, for the most part, you're thinking maybe single room to two room, you know, houses. Yeah. So this is definitely an extraordinary statement of Allen's wealth and success.
I have been to a place in Tennessee called the Blunt Mansion, and it was the home of William Blunt, who was the only signer of the Constitution to have left a house outside the original 13 states. Okay, so it's very significant. He's a signer, all the rest of it. But this mansion of his would have fit in one of your rooms here. Mm-hmm. It was out on the frontier, and I don't think he was as well off. He wanted to be. He was quite a scoundrel, actually. But his house was not nearly this grand. This is a grand house. So the original 1665 house was 5,300 square feet. Mm-hmm. That's a big honking house. Even mm-hmm. today, that's a big house. Mm-hmm. So where did this guy come from? How did he get all this money? Was he that successful with tobacco?
So we know that he was christened in Droitwich, England in about 1608, and first appeared in the Jamestown records in the 1630s. 1649 is when he acquired his land grant here. But he continued to trade through Bristol while he was... Bristol, England, yeah.
And you've also mentioned Jamestown, and let's just orient people. Jamestown is right on the James River, mm-hmm. okay? And this is on the... Okay. It's on the north branch, or the north side of it, excuse me. And we're in the south, right?
We're on the south side.
We're on the south side here.
Yeah.
So basically, Bacon's plantation is...
This is Allen's plantation.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, Dan. I'm sorry. Allen built his plantation, mm-hmm. and this is about 60 years after Jamestown is founded, right. and he built it southeast of Jamestown, correct? And about 20 miles away, I'm guessing?
Not even. Okay. I mean, as a crow flies, we're 3 miles from the water, and you cross the ferry, so
right.
you have to cross, what is it, about 2 miles across the river,
okay.
and then 3 miles. So it's 5 miles from Jamestown.
Well, it's only five. Oh, yeah. See, I drove in from Williamsburg.
Right.
That's why I was thinking 20 miles. But from Jamestown, it was not that far.
Right.
So this is, I guess at this time, was sort of an outlying plantation.
Well,
Jamestown was the center.
You know, there's some speculation that Arthur Allen is actually hedging his bets, because by the time he's building this, there's already Green Springs, which is Governor Barclay's home. And a lot of plantations have started cropping up on the north side of the James River. So there's Arthur Allen is kind of speculating that this side is really going to bring in the big bucks.
This is the next big thing.
Right. This is the next big thing. Exactly.
Understood. You were going to add, Joan?
Well, I was just going to say, even as early as 1620s, I think people had settled this area, and farming hogs was a common practice on this side, which has been a well-established.
Hog Island is not far
from
here.
Exactly. Tradition. But the counties were basically drawn by 1668, and that's how, if you were a planter, that's how you would essentially rise to power if you were elected, well, not even elected, basically named to represent your county on the council. And Arthur Allen was a justice of the peace for Surrey County. I can see also for political gain, it would kind of make sense, in other words, to spread out so that, you know, if you're...
Well, but it's also just part of the natural progression. You had the Jamestown people come in, they settle the town, they establish their what's going to be their capital city for a while, and then people arrive. The mm-hmm. population grows, babies are born, and people are spreading out, and they're starting to farm tobacco for export. Mm-hmm. And the ships are coming up and down the river, taking it back to England, Bristol being one major port there. So, okay, and I think we've placed him sort of right. in time and place, all right?
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with two very knowledgeable ladies from a group called Preservation Virginia. Their names are Jen and Joanna, and we're at a place called Bacon's Castle. Never heard of it, have you? Well, unless, of course, you've been listening, in which case now you know what it is. It's a fascinating place, and it's the locus, or at least one site, of something called Bacon's Rebellion, which happened about 100 years before our American Revolution. After the break, we have a special treat for you. Since we're going back so far in time, I thought maybe we'd reach back and play a vintage quiz featuring the Quiz Lady. Stay tuned. Again, gathered for that most august of occasions, that greatest challenge that we have in all of constitutional law, the constitutional quiz. And with us is our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael. Kelly, are you there?
I am here. Hello.
Tremendous. We also have a very brave contestant who is walking the lion's den. Please introduce yourself, Mr. Contestant, and tell us where you're from.
Hi, I'm Zach Rivenbark from Bergall, North Carolina.
Zach, are you ready?
I am.
You're ready to face the quiz lady?
I think so.
All right, quiz lady, he's ready for you. Let's go.
All right, Zach, I have a question for you. I'm actually going to read a quotation for you, and then you're going to determine what concept the quotation refers to. And this is, you know, when you study the Constitution, you also really need to go back to the Declaration of Independence and look at some of the principles that are laid out in the Declaration of Independence. So are you ready for me, Zach?
I am.
All right, here's the quote. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Does that quotation from the Declaration of Independence refer to the concept of A, inalienable rights, B, natural law theory, C, right of revolution, or D, social contract theory?
Could you repeat the quotation or question one more time?
Sure thing. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
And what were the answer choices, please, Kelly?
Sure. A, inalienable rights, B, natural law theory, C, right of revolution, or D, social contract theory.
Those are all good choices, and I can see Zach beginning to sweat. Beads of sweat are dripping down his forehead. Zach, why don't you walk us through
this? It's a good thing that I'm not in the studio with you, Sir, because I fear sometimes that our contestants might throw things at me.
They would. They just cower in a fetal position in the corner when you walked in. But at any rate, Zach, why don't you walk us through those answer choices and tell us what your thoughts are?
Well, I think it's A, inalienable rights.
Okay, why do you think it's A?
It's a guess, an educated guess,
educated,
I think.
But what about inalienable rights relates to that quote that we just had?
The just powers, I think, okay, led me to that answer.
So justice, the just powers from the consent of the governed. Okay, well, what about B, natural law? Why didn't you choose that one?
I don't think that applies to the consent of the governed people or any powers derived therefrom.
Okay. What is natural law? I've never been able to figure that anyway.
That's why I didn't choose that one, me either.
Well, that's why I always study unnatural law. Yeah, I much prefer it. Okay, so C, what about that one? What was that one again?
That was right of a revolution.
Right of revolution.
Well, I do think that there were obviously rights to have a revolution, or at least we did have a revolution, and I think there were just powers that allowed that, but I'm sticking with inalienable rights.
Yeah, it didn't talk about anything. The statement that Kelly read didn't talk about anybody getting shot.
No.
So maybe that's a good way to eliminate C. What do you think about D, social contract?
Again, I didn't see any reasoning or any issue that led me to a social issue or social right.
Social right. What about that contract?
The contract, I guess, could go to the just powers from consent But I'm sticking, I think, with the inalienable rights for that reason.
Is that your final answer?
It is.
Kelly?
I know it's a really good thing I'm not in the studio because I think I'd be thrown out. The right answer is social contract theory, but I do like your rationale, and I think you know, Stuart helped you out a little bit with the idea of consent. But particularly the beginning of the quotation is governments are instituted among men, and social contract theory, the idea that you're giving up some of your rights to government. Inalienable rights are rights that government can never take away from you. They are your rights. But social contract theory is you're giving up some of your rights so you can be governed among men.
Exactly right. And incidentally, let me apologize to all the ladies back in the 18th century. They were enlightened, but not so enlightened that they included women as well. But hey, history is what it is, and we have to go with it. And we very much appreciate Zach's attempt today. It was a brave one.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Kelly.
Did you enjoy that vintage quiz with the old quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael? We sure miss her around here. That was fun. We're also talking to two other ladies today. We're talking to Jen and Joanna from Preservation, Virginia. We're at a place called Bacon's Castle. It's not really a castle. It's really more like an English manor house built right here in Virginia 350 years ago this year. And it was a place that featured very prominently in something called Bacon's Rebellion. Now, we've had to do a lot of foundational work to explain about the society around Jamestown, Virginia, and what was happening then and what the tensions were. But we're just about to start getting to the good stuff. So let's go back to Jen and Joanna.
So let's go ahead and talk about, you kind of mentioned the idea of succession. So
right.
Then we have Arthur Allen II. I should preface this by saying that by the time that Arthur Allen I has finished this house, he's in his 60s.
Allen I and Allen II, these guys had delusions of grandeur, didn't they?
There's an Arthur Allen III as well.
Arthur Allen III.
The name continues on.
The name continues on. All right. Well, I think these guys really had a fairly high opinion of themselves, but that's all right. Go ahead.
So Arthur Allen I only lives 4 years before he passes away. And then the home goes to Arthur Allen II.
So this is about 1669.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So Arthur Allen II has actually gone back to England to be educated. So he's back in his father's hometown in Droitwich. And the timing is such that you've just finished the English Civil War and you've had the restoration of the monarchy. And so you have pretty much this... The Civil War is a return to conservatism in England. It's very Protestant values. And then when you have the restoration of the monarchy, the pendulum swings the complete other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the environment that Arthur Allen II is going to school and getting his education in England. So by the time he comes back here, he's thoroughly immersed in the pleasures of a civilized society. And now he is the master of a plantation in the wilderness.
Yeah, I mean, it's grand for the locality, but
right.
It doesn't really compare with Mayfair now, does it?
Right.
Yeah.
So basically, he tries his best to bring a little bit of that civility with him. So we get what is currently in North America known as the oldest English formal garden.
Really?
That we have outside, right? So this is a pleasure garden. It's not really for sustenance. There may have been some herbs, maybe a few pieces of fruit that you could pick, but really the garden, and it's an acre and a half, is completely to walk around and enjoy.
That's interesting. You know, I'd never thought about that term, pleasure garden. It has sort of a racy aspect to it today, but I think...
Oh, it did then, too.
Oh, it did? Well, let me finish my thought, and then I want to hear more about this. I mean, most gardens are kitchen gardens, right? Or maybe they're market gardens if mm-hmm. you're going to sell.
Okay.
I passed a couple of market gardens on my way here. I understand that pleasure garden is a place just to go and have pleasure. And now I want you to tell me the racy part. Was that really what the people did?
So the archaeology that's been done on the garden, which was funded by the Garden Club of Virginia, and we have uncovered these areas called exedras. And typically an exedra is an alcove on the outskirts of the garden that is walled with usually tall shrubbery, and it's going to have a brick bench that's going to have fragrant herbs planted on top of the bench that you can sit on. But the point is that it's a private space.
This was the 17th century equivalent of the back seat of your dad's car. That's what we're talking about here, aren't we? Okay, well, people were people even then, and young ladies and young men wanted to get together. They wanted a little privacy. Okay, we're not going to...
possible. We don't have any documented evidence.
But there was a bench, for heaven's sake. Okay, we'll just leave that thought there. Okay.
But this kind of gives you an idea of Arthur Allen II. He's in this grand manor home. He's in the House of Burgess. He's very good friends with the elite, the first families of Virginia. So from this point, you start to see what leads up to the rebellion that becomes known as Bacon's Rebellion.
Okay, very good. So we're at roughly 1670. We've got Arthur Allen II. He's built
his garden.
His garden, his pleasure garden. He's acting the high and mighty English lord. Mm-hmm. And what happens next?
We place now Allen in 1669, and then when you look at the broader context of what's going on in Virginia and globally, in 1668, England actually passed navigation acts limiting the English, basically ending the colonist trade of tobacco with the Dutch.
Yeah, this is the mercantile system where they're trying to control all the trade within their empire.
Control the trade. Yeah. And, you know, the Dutch routes were, Dutch trade was considered more favorable for the colonists.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, they took a big hit that way.
Those damn English. They were at it already. 100 years before the revolution, they were... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just feeling patriotic here. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
And, of course, you know, that did help spark the Anglo-Dutch Wars. And the English had the government had raised taxes on the colonists here to build forts and protection Jamestown from the Dutch. And in 1673, actually both in 1668 and 1673, a Dutch fleet came sailing straight past whatever barricade they had set up.
Right.
And so the colonists are aware of this. You know, they're unhappy because there's an overabundance of tobacco. The tobacco prices are not that great even at this point in 17th century, which is kind of...
And now the English aren't letting them sell their tobacco to the Dutch who want to buy it.
Yeah. So you actually did have a small petition, I guess you would say. It's not a complete revolt, but on Hogs Island, just prior to Bacon's Rebellion, which was in 1676. That was by 14 Surrey colonists who had basically petitioned the government, they were unhappy about the taxes. And so you start to see a little bit of parallels between the 17th century and then later.
I'm going to draw another parallel, and this is something that, without sounding too cynical, I hope, or too modernist or too presentist, this was like a battle between two drug lords. It really was. I mean, tobacco's a drug, okay? That's why people want it. It's full of nicotine. And that's what we were producing, okay? And somebody wanted to control the drug trade. We wanted free drug trade because we wanted to sell our drugs to whomever wanted them. And the English wanted to control that, and the Dutch wanted theirs, and it was all about money and controlling the trade.
And the whole the other underlying theme is that then not only were we not allowed to sell our tobacco, but we were being taxed to build these forts too. So then there's
higher taxes and the lower.
Oh, those British again! Again! How dare they? How dare they?
I could see if I were a planter in Virginia at that time,
I feel like unfurling a banner or something. All right, let's. Okay.
Or even somebody who's just making my way, which, right. We've talked about Allen a little bit and the elite planters. But at that time, there's a growing population of people who are just moving from England who are trying to establish their own farm, similar to Nathaniel Bacon. He mm-hmm. actually appears in 1674.
Right.
Nathaniel
Bacon, mm-hmm. okay, and that's the first guy we've heard of named Bacon. He shows up in 1674. He's a troublemaker.
It's rumored that he's a troublemaker. I can say this. When he married Elizabeth Duke, her father disinherited her because he did not approve of it. This is in England.
Okay, so back in England, Nathaniel Bacon marries a woman named Elizabeth Duke, mm-hmm. and her father's response is to disinherit her. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing he's a rogue. That's what I'm thinking. Nathaniel Bacon sounds like a rogue to me.
It sounds a little bit that way. And so he's from, you know, a pretty prominent family. He was from Suffolk, England, and his father's response is to send him to Virginia to have his cousins look after him. And one of his cousins, believe it or not, is Governor Sir William Barclay. So you can see how the
he's pretty well connected. Yeah.
Later in well, it's actually through his wife. I should say it's through marriage. It's through Barclay's wife. But
these people all knew each other. You used a term a moment ago, Jen, the first families of Virginia. A lot of people have heard that term, but it really has a literal meaning. I mean, these people are the ones who trace themselves back all the way to Jamestown, right?
Well, it's not just that. It's the dynasties. It's the families that came here and built pretty much the early, if we're, you know, going along on the whole drug trade kind of thing.
Right.
These are the empire builders. These are the ones
we broadcast very widely in Virginia, and I think we've just insulted most of the social elite in Virginia. Sorry, guys. When you look back in your genealogy, it's not always pretty now, is it? All right. So these are the okay. Right, on we go.
You know, Barclay even names Bacon, as, you know, he gives him a seat on the council.
Right.
You have, I guess, going back to it, you have newcomers like Bacon who maybe not necessarily have the same familial ties, but settle on the outskirts of Jamestown, further west. Bacon actually settled in Henrico County.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to orient people, where's Henrico County?
Outside of Richmond.
Okay, and yeah, so that's to our west.
To our west.
So mm-hmm. Jamestown is now in James County.
Right.
Okay, Henrico is to the west
to
of
the
that,
west of
and
it.
We are just across the river to the south
the
in Surrey County.
That's correct.
And do we know why they didn't put the E in there like they did in Britain? I came across and I didn't see the E in Surrey County. Do we know?
I don't know.
Someone misspelled something. Okay, so here we are in misspelled Surrey County. All right, now we're oriented. So he's over, Nathaniel Bacon, you said, was settled in Henrico County.
Yes.
Okay.
At that time, if you were an indentured servant who initially came over for 5 to 7 years in hopes of being able to establish your own farm or plantation after your service on site, even by the 1660s, there's really not a whole lot of land available to you near Jamestown. So you have, you know, a pretty good faction of former indentured servants who also end up settling further to the west.
Now, when you say indentured servants, you're mm-hmm. talking white folk and black folk, right? Or is it all mostly white folk in the indentured servant category?
Mostly European. Actually, in 1670, believe it or not, the legislation passed a law which forbade African-American landowners from using the headright system to claim European indentured servants.
Okay, so there was already racism was rearing its ugly head.
You do start to see that. But, you know, it's kind of a... It's complicated. It's not so clear as indentured servants were white, and, you know, it's not like that because, you know, obviously you do have African-American slaves in Jamestown as early as 1620s. You do have a fair amount of indentured servants, but you also have Virginia Indian tribes trading prisoners from other tribes into slavery as well.
Right. What I'm trying to get to, and I think we're going to talk about this later, is that slavery in this country, though it certainly came almost with the Jamestown settlers very shortly thereafter, was not as racially defined. It wasn't as African-American only as it later became. And so
right.
It was more complicated early on.
It's more complicated, yeah.
But, I mean, to basically sum it up, an African slave could buy their freedom. And if their children were baptized, then their children could be free very early on.
Wow.
This is no longer the case by the end of the 17th century. This is no longer the case, but very early on.
So the slavery was not like a set piece institution. It developed gradually and it had variations. Okay.
Yeah.
And there were pathways out of slavery just as there was an end point to indentured servitude.
Right. And so both here in Surrey County and also up towards more of Henrico County, you do have freed slaves that have purchased their own property and are working alongside indentured servant or freed indentured servants as well as pretty wealthy landowners like Nathaniel Bacon. So that's kind of the layout that you have in Henrico. And I guess at this point, it's also really good to mention kind of some of the Virginia Indian disputes that were happening at that time too.
Yeah.
So I'll let Joanna talk about that.
Starting out in, it was 1675, there were, you know, disputes before that, but this was sort of the major one that sparked what we now refer to as Bacon's Rebellion. But further north from here, around the Potomac, the Susquehannocks had settled there. They were basically displaced from the north by the Iroquois. And in that time, Thomas Mathew, who was a Matthew? Sorry.
One of those
lack
guys.
Of pronunciations.
Okay. Thomas.
But he settled on the Potomac as well. You also have the Doegs in that area.
The Doeg Indians.
The Doeg Indians.
D-O-E-G. Okay, that's not familiar for most people, I don't think.
The Doegs come and raid his property, claiming that he didn't properly compensate them in trade, basically. And so Virginia's response, Barclay sends out George Mason as well as John Washington on, I don't know if you would say mission, as you will, against...
A punitive expedition.
Punitive expedition, thank you.
Okay.
But in that expedition, they come across a Susquehannock tribe. Unfortunately, they mistake the Susquehannocks for the Doegs. We had originally established peace treaties with the Susquehannocks, and that's why they felt safe in that Potomac region. But they end up killing members of the Susquehannock tribe afterwards.
And let's be clear about this. They killed men.
Men and women, yes.
And children.
And children.
Now we've established that we have drug dealing, slave owning, massacring forebears.
You know, I mean...
It was a complicated time. This is not shaping up as the chest-thumping patriotic story I wanted to hear. You're messing with my mind here.
And it doesn't get better because when the Susquehannocks go to arrange some sort of truce, they end up shooting or killing some of the chiefs of the Susquehannocks. So that instigated the Susquehannocks raid of the Rappahannock in January of 1676.
The Rappahannock tribe?
The Rappahannock River, around that area.
It was a raid in that area. Okay.
They decided, you know, they're no longer safe in the Potomac area. They've decided they, you know, have to find a place where they can happily reside. They start moving south, and in that effort, they're also seeking... retribution.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And so they end up killing somewhere between 36 to 60 Virginian colonists, including they go even further south from Rappahannock, even down to Henrico County, where.
Let's be fair. I imagine that some of those colonists were women and children as well.
As well.
So
yes,
I mean, there are atrocities being committed on both sides.
And of course,
terrible,
you know,
course.
there were raids before this as well.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with two very knowledgeable and interesting women named Jen and Joanna at a place called Bacon's Castle near Williamsburg, near Jamestown, Virginia. And we're learning all about the 17th century, not the 18th century, but the 1600s, the first century during which British settlers were here in the United States. And we're learning about the conflicts that eventually led to something called Bacon's Rebellion. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and we'll come back and speak some more with Jen and Joanna. Stick around.
We do not know exactly how James Madison came into possession and effective management of the Montpelier plantation. Since he was the eldest son, despite his absorption in public life, Virginia tradition strongly favored his assumption of that privilege and responsibility. In the 1780s, his letters to his father and to his brother Ambrose show clearly that they were in charge at Montpelier. Cousin Francis Taylor's diary likewise pictures James Madison as a politician and scholar who, until the mid-1790s, really only visited in Orange County. He wrote about the plantation during visits home, encouraged scientific farming methods, purchased supplies in Philadelphia, and sometimes oversaw the marketing of Montpelier produce, but otherwise he left things to his father and brother. As late as 1787, he held virtually no property in his own name, a fact which has led some students to rank him among the least substantial members of the Federal Convention. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Jennifer Hurst Wender and Joanna Braswell, two very knowledgeable women from Preservation, Virginia, and were at a place called Bacon's Castle, which featured very prominently in a 17th century rebellion. That's back in the 1600s in Virginia, called Bacon's Rebellion. And it seems that Bacon's Rebellion was sparked, at least, by a dispute with local Native Americans. And sadly, there had been massacres on both sides and all sorts of atrocities, and feelings were running very high when a fellow named Nathaniel Bacon entered the fray.
But one of the unfortunate colonists to suffer from this was Nathaniel Bacon, because they did capture and kill his overseer, which was really more unfortunate for them, I should say, because it was at this time that Bacon, and obviously those colonists who had suffered from that raid wanted to seek even more retribution.
So Bacon's living in Henrico. He's out in the western frontier, and his right-hand man has just been killed in a raid, and he's angry.
Right.
Okay.
And there were a couple of other landowners, William Byrd I, in fact.
That's one of the first family that recognized that name, the Byrd family. Yeah.
Yeah, who were not left untouched by the raid, I'll put it that way. Barclay initially orders a band under Chichley of about 300 men to go after the tribe. Before it disembarks, Barclay changes his mind and disbands it. And instead, he calls for an assembly. And what comes out of the assembly is that a series of forts is going to be built in protection of the colonists, as well as no colonist should attack an Indian tribe. He's going to leave it up to the Pamunkey tribe, who were allies, close friends of the Virginians, to handle all disputes. Well, as you can imagine, those men, like Bacon, who had suffered that raid, are not happy at all with this, because these forts that were being built, he's requiring those men on the western frontier basically to build those forts and then pay for them, because he's obviously going to have to raise taxes to build the forts.
So the governor wants to conciliate, but the guys who are directly, that feel like they're most affected, don't want to conciliate. Mm-hmm. They just want to go kick butt and take names. Again, I'm reminded of William Blunt. 100 years later, there was a western edge, and that was Tennessee. And Tennessee eventually separated from North Carolina after a couple of attempts to do so. And one of the big issues was, we want to deal harshly with the native population out here in the West, and you people back in Raleigh aren't doing enough for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bet this occurred again and again throughout colonial history.
Yeah, you see it at Culpeper Rebellion further south in North Carolina after. Essentially, those living on the western frontier, they don't feel like they're getting the protection or support that they need from Barclay or Jamestown. So there's a group of volunteers along Jordan's Point area in the spring of 1676 who decide, they're going to handle matters on their own. They elect Bacon as their leader. At this point, he's old at this point. He had successfully settled a dispute with Powhatans back in the 1640s. It's now 1670s. He's close to retirement as is. William Byrd, Bacon, William Drummond, some other of those wealthy landowners that we were speaking about, they decide that, he's just weak. At this point, they don't trust him to make good responses. That's a large part of it as well. They elect Bacon as their leader. Well, word gets back to Barclay, and Barclay sends a note. It would seem that perhaps Barclay at this point would really take matters into his own hands and just nip it in the bud, as it were. But he just sends a note to Bacon warning him, basically saying, don't even go that route. Bacon doesn't heed Barclay's caution, and in May of 1676, Barclay decides to go ahead and send out a proclamation flat out ordering Bacon to stop. This is May 10th, and Bacon once again doesn't submit to Barclay, so Barclay decides he's going to remove Bacon's seat from the council, and he's at this point calling Bacon a rebel. But really, by May of 1676, you start to see Bacon's rebellion really coming into full here.
What Bacon really wanted to do was go out and fight the Indians, but he had to, or at least he felt he had to, fight his own government first in order to do what he wanted to do.
Obviously, he harbors harsh feelings against the Virginia Indians, but I think it really does become then a power struggle between Bacon and Barclay. in many ways, you could say Bacon is using the Indian campaign as an excuse.
And it may very well have been. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. And let's recall now that the governor is appointed by the crown.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the king's representative in the colony. And Bacon is, though he's very well connected, he is not the king's representative. And so in some sense, he represents the colonists and their interests.
But there's so he has only been in town for a couple of years.
Well, I said he was a troublemaker, right?
Yeah.
He was spoiling for a fight.
So his rise to so-called power has been, I think it went to his head. All of a sudden, everybody's saying, you should be our leader.
Right.
And he has all of these colonists rallying around him.
It's a power high.
Right.
This is why we need more women in government.
Oh.
I can see this is a subject that's come up with you before. Okay, but that's a whole nother subject.
Yeah, that's
go
a whole,
on.
In May, one of the major events that happened in that month, the Okanishi, they spot Susquehannocks, and they basically alert Bacon and some of his men that the Susquehannocks are nearby. And they go into negotiation with Bacon to go ahead and attack the Susquehannocks. So Bacon at that point is working with that tribe as well as some of the other tribes in the region, the Maharans and others. Well, after the Okanichis raid the Susquehannocks, Bacon ends up feeling that he's not getting properly compensated by the Okanichis. And so Bacon and his men end up also killing part of the Okanishi, taking some into capture. And
this guy Bacon is sounding less and less sympathetic.
And it's a little bit murky. I mean, it was more Bacon's men at this point, that event. But that happened to me. Well, the governor, once again, he's removed Bacon's seat from council, and he's not looked too favorably, obviously, by the planters at this point. He'd also tried to diversify the crops, which was something that also angered the planters because ultimately it resulted in even higher taxes on the tobacco. And so he's decided, okay, well, start anew. He basically calls for elections for new assembly, and much to his dismay, Bacon is voted in to the House of Burgesses by the James crew.
Oh,
so,
boy. Just can't get rid of this guy.
And so Bacon arrives for the assembly in Jamestown in June. Barclay and his men spot him. Barclay orders the gunners to take down Bacon's ship. Bacon surrenders, and he's put on trial at the assembly, but the governor forgave him and allowed him to take his seat back in this assembly, which is kind of interesting.
The summary is by this point, because Governor Barclay started out as a governor for the people, it seemed overwhelmingly early in Governor Barclay's career that he was a real champion for the Virginians and represented them quite well to the crown. So the shift when he gets older, it seems like he's become more philosophical, kind of the idea that this crop rotation is going to work, it's going to be better for people, but maybe it's not as good on the grounds. And again, with the Virginia Indian tribes, he's made trade agreements, and so that's why he's so leery of actually going out and fighting them.
He actually sounds like a pretty reasonable guy to me, and maybe that's because I'm getting old, but crop rotation, especially when you've got a plant like tobacco, which depletes the soil rapidly,
right.
Now that's
well,
important. That sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, his that theory was certainly something that he wanted Virginia to be successful, and so he thought by diversifying the crops, that it could operate as a colony on its own.
Did that cause the parliament to raise the tax on tobacco?
Well, it didn't cause them to, I shouldn't say it that way, but basically his attempts to try to diversify the crop did not work. The planters really didn't sign on to it, and in the end, you did have the higher taxes. So by this point, he's really not, like I was saying, I mean, he's only popular to his close friends and the elite. But anyway, at this assembly, going back to this June assembly, Bacon, once again, is allowed to take his seat in the assembly. But at the assembly, they also have a chief of the Pamunkey tribe at that point, and Barclay is, you know, showing them that they're going to allow, you know, they've got this friendship, and the Pamunkey tribe are really going to handle putting out all the other, you know, whatever atrocities, I should say, whatever raids happen.
Right.
And she's a woman. And so
the chief is a woman. Well, whoa, and so this is something else I did not know.
Yeah. So you can imagine that most of the people there at the assembly, you know, they're not too happy about this. Definitely not Bacon. And once again, Bacon goes in front of the assembly, begs for the commission to continue his cause against the Virginia Indians. And Barclay denies Bacon. So, you know, we have said it that he had established the peace treaties with some of the Virginia Indian tribes. Also, it's rumored, though not fully substantiated, I know you were saying that, you know, he sounds like a reasonable guy, but it is rumored that he was receiving financial incentives or kickbacks through his own personal trade in furs with some of the tribes.
It
would seem he'd have personal reasons for not getting involved.
So maybe Governor Barclay was not quite the wise.
I mean, you know, it's certainly what I like about, you know, going back over Bacon's Rebellion definitely here is that you do see that history is more complicated. You know, even earlier in the 20th century, sometimes Bacon is regarded as an early American hero for being one of the first patriots, whatever, you know,
but when
you go back in time, you realize, I mean, it's the same thing what we're learning about, you know, the founding fathers as well as we progress in time, you know.
They're not
heroes, right? Oh, you're ruining my life. No, okay, but one thing is clear, though. Okay, we want to correct the historical record, is that we do appropriately revere Nathaniel Bacon as the inventor of the bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. Right? But don't tell me you're going to explode that myth.
No.
Okay, all right, back to 1676. So Bacon is protesting. He doesn't like this attempt to make peace. He doesn't like what Governor Barclay's doing. What happens next?
So at this point, Bacon flees from the assembly. And in June, he gathers like about 400 men, I think, thereabouts, to reapproach the governor. And they have a meeting outside.
Wait, you're going to go talk to the governor with 400 men. Okay, mm-hmm. This is not a talk, though.
No,
okay.
No, it's more like a force measure.
Okay, all right.
It's basically arguing again for the commission. And this also, when he fled from the assembly, Governor Barclay basically is calling him a traitor, and he's going to hold him accountable for treason. So Bacon's gone to, you know, renegotiate terms, if you will, with support.
400 bayonets.
Yeah.
Or muskets,
and
at least. Uh-huh.
Finally, you know, in front of the State House, Barclay is unwilling to change his stance, even with, you know, those men behind Bacon. Barclay turns to Bacon, draws open his coat, and offers Bacon a cheap shot.
Seriously?
Saying,
so Bacon's standing there with people pointing guns at him, and he says, okay.
Okay, I'm not going to change, you know.
No, Barclay.
Barclay.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
Bacon is threatening Barclay.
Bacon, yeah,
and
exactly.
Barclay, instead of running away or receding, simply opens his coat and says, okay, go ahead, shoot me.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm respecting Barclay a bit more. He's got some guts here.
And so ends another episode of your weekly constitutional 17th century edition. Will Bacon actually shoot Barclay? Will Bacon go on trial? Will the United States ever be formed? Tune in next week to find out the fascinating answers. I'm Stuart Harris, and I want to thank very much Jennifer Hurst Wender and Joanna Braswell of Preservation, Virginia. What a great, great interview we've had today at Bacon's Castle, the site or part of the site of something called Bacon's Rebellion. And you really will have to tune in next week if you want to hear the rest of the story. And believe me, it's worth doing. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our Madison Minute is by, what's that guy's name again? Blaylock? Is that what it is, Wayne? Blaylock? Jim Blaylock. Yeah, I thought that was what it was. Who plays 17th century music on occasion. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.